This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. In honor of Pope Francis' first visit to the United States, we're going to listen to Terry's interview with Paul Vallely, author of the book Pope Francis, The Struggle for the Soul of Catholicism. Terry asks Vallely about the changes Pope Francis has made in the Church, changes in the Church's position on the role of women in the Church, and on homosexuality, marriage annulment, and divorce. Paul Vallely is a former deputy editor of the British newspaper The Independent and teaches public ethics and media at the University of Chester in England. His other books include The New Politics, Catholic Social Teaching for the 21st Century, and Bad Samaritans, First World Ethics and Third World Debt. Vallely's book, Pope Francis, was published in August. This interview was recorded on September 15th.
Paul Vallely, welcome to Fresh Air. So what is the goal of the Pope's visit to the United States?
The Pope is visiting and he's addressing many audiences. He's addressing the Congress and the political elite. He's seeing the President. He's seeing the United Nations world leaders to talk about sustainable development. But he's also talking to the US bishops. Most importantly, he's talking to the ordinary people of America. And he's mindful of a fifth audience, which is that although he's here in the richest country in the world, he is the Pope for the poor. And he's very aware that the eyes and ears of the poor world are on everything he does and says.
The Pope has been leading reforms in the Vatican, but you say he's not as liberal as some liberals think. Can you expand on that?
Well, a lot of secular liberals think that a liberal pope would change the church teaching on abortion and contraception and gay marriage and those kind of issues. The Pope has not shown any signal of changing doctrine. And so in that sense, he's orthodox. And that makes him not a liberal in the way that the world uses that term. He's perhaps a liberal within the church, but I think that's slightly more complicated. What he is somebody who wants to change the tone of the church. And there was a very good example of this the other day. He did a virtual audience for American cities that he won't be able to visit. And he was talking to ordinary Catholics in Chicago and Los Angeles and on the Mexican Texas border. And there was one woman there who she told her life story to him and said that her children had had a very hard life, and she broke down in tears when she was doing it. And he said to her, "No, you're a brave woman. You've done your best for your children, and you brought them into the world. You could have had an abortion in your difficult situation, but you didn't." Now, that is absolutely classic. He's taking the church's line on abortion. He's saying it's wrong, it's a grave sin, but he's not saying it in a kind of finger-wagging, condemnatory way. He's saying it in a kind of compassionate way and saying, encouraging someone who he sees as having done the right thing. So he's not changing teaching, but he's changing the way that it's put across and the warmth with which the church relates to ordinary people.
I'm a little confused about his position on women in the church. He said he wants a profound new theology of women, but at the same time he's ruled out women becoming priests.
Well, you're not the only one who's a little confused on that. And he knows that there's an issue. He knows there's a problem, but he's got no idea what the solution is. I mean, he's a man of a certain age from a culture in Latin America, which is quite macho, and he has very high regard for women, but in the sense of, you know, aren't they lovely? Think about my mother, think about my grandmother and what wonderful examples they were. He's not very up on the role of women in the professional world. He has worked for a woman boss. He's had a good friend who was a female lawyer during the military regime in Argentina, and they work closely together. And he's spoken, for instance, about how equal pay is an imperative, and it's a scandal that women aren't paid well. But when it comes to theology, he doesn't want women priests. He was asked, why not have women cardinals? Because cardinals don't have to be priests. No, we've got enough clerics in the church. We don't want any more. Well, what about women heading departments in the Vatican? Well, you've got to be a cardinal to head a department in the Vatican. So no real action in the areas which are open to him. He could perhaps make some movement on women becoming deacons, which is the, you know, the step before you become a priest. But he betrays his background even when he's doing the right thing. He brought five women onto the International Theological Commission, and then having announced them and said, oh, we need more of these women because they're the strawberries on the cake. One of the leading women theologians said, yeah, well, if we're the strawberries, the men are the nuts. But you get the idea that even when he's trying to do the right thing, he's still steeped in this kind of background, which makes it difficult for him to know how he's kind of paralyzed and conflicted about it, really. He wants a profound new theology for women, but he's got no idea what that means.
And let's relate that to the issue of birth control. He's defended the Catholic ban on contraception, but he's also said that Catholics shouldn't breed like rabbits and they should exercise responsible parenthood. Is he preaching abstinence there? What is he saying?
Well, what is he preaching? I think he's trying to replace the old idea of papal infallibility with the doctrine of papal fallibility, because he seems to be contradicting himself there, and no one's quite sure. I think one of the interesting things about contraception is that in the past, the Church has looked at it from a kind of philosophical and theological way and said it's against the natural law and all that kind of thing. This Pope is the first Pope from the Global South, so he looks at it differently. He thinks that population control is a plot by the rich to try and make sure that the poor can be controlled so that the rich can continue to take a disproportionate proportion of the world's resources. So he's ending up in the same place as previous popes, but going at it by an entirely different route. And he says that he acknowledges that people are going to have problems with contraception. He says, oh, priests should be merciful and understanding in confession. So you're kind of supposed to go in and confess that you're doing it, but you won't get ticked off too much. So it is quite confusing. But it's part of his general position, who am I to judge on homosexuality and so forth, where he's sending out a softer kind of message. He wants the Church to be welcoming, inclusive, compassionate, merciful. Mercy is his key word. And he doesn't want it to be condemnatory and judgmental as it's been in the past. So it's like keeping the words and changing the tune.
But, you know, do you see it as a step forward? For instance, on homosexuality, he said, who am I to judge? And he wants to kind of welcome homosexuals into the Church, but that's not the same as saying homosexuals should have equal rights or the Church is going to endorse gay marriage. So how do you parse what he's said on homosexuality?
Well, he thinks homosexuals should have equal rights. He's very keen on that. And when he was Archbishop of Buenos Aires, he was in favor of civil unions. He's against gay marriage because he thinks marriage is the key word. It's sacramental. It's between a man and a woman. And two men or two women can't be married. But they can have a civil union and they should have equal rights. Again, if you look at gay adoption, that's another interesting nuance from his point of view. He thinks that gay adoption shouldn't be seen as an issue about the rights of parents. It should be about the rights of children. And children have the right to a mother and a father. So he's in favour of civil unions. He's against gay marriage. He's against gay adoption. It's quite a complicated position. But I don't think it's necessarily contradictory. It's just more subtle than the previous Church position, which was to condemn and call homosexual acts morally intrinsically evil. So I think what you're seeing with this Pope is a kind of holding up of ideals and counsels of perfection and saying, well, we all know that we fall short of these and everyone's a sinner and I'm a sinner and I've committed hundreds of errors in my past. So we just have to be more merciful with one another.
How much pushback is Pope Francis getting from more conservative clergy in the Vatican?
He's getting a huge amount of resistance. Some of it is public and some of it is behind the scenes and quite subtle in the Roman bureaucracy, the Curia, people trying to block things that he wants to do or delay them, drag their feet. And occasionally he will, as with his reforms on the Vatican Bank, he'll realise that people are doing this and he'll sack entire boards of cardinals and so forth. He's quite a ruthless political operator. But he wants to hear the dissent of conservatives. conservatives. He actually said, let's get this debate out into the open. It's healthy to hear. Resistance is good because it's better than it being papered over or behind the scenes. And then we can have, if disagreement is no longer dissent but is healthy debate, then we can go forward in a new way. So what we're seeing is the start of a process rather than a finished product.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Paul Vallely. He's the author of the book Pope Francis, The Struggle for the Soul of Catholicism. And he has written extensively about the Pope and the Vatican. So the Pope has appointed, I think it's 39 cardinals. And you say they're pastors rather than culture war ideologues. Only 14 of them are from Europe. One is from the United States. And the others are largely coming from...
I don't think there's any from the United States.
Okay, stand corrected on that. And you say the others are coming from poor countries, many of them small countries. How is that reshaping the Vatican?
Well, the next pope will be elected by the College of Cardinals. And the popes appointed 39 people to that, none of whom are from America, and only a tiny number of whom are from Europe. And in for the first time, the European cardinals are not in a majority in this college. And the number of people from developing countries is now 42%. So if he carries on every year appointing more cardinals, he could be in a position where the majority of them are from what we used to call the third world when it comes to electing the next pope. Obviously, that will be a profound shift because they will bring different priorities to the election and may well elect a different kind of person. And that shift has sent a signal to people in the United States and in Europe to say, you're not the center of the church anymore. The church has been too Eurocentric, and the American church has had too much power through its wealth, and that's changing. And that's a profound shift.
I'm wondering if you think that shift in the cardinals will have cultural implications that take the church in the opposite direction than Pope Francis has been heading in. Because I know in some churches, it's the developing countries that are culturally very conservative in terms of women and in terms of homosexuality.
That could be the case. But I think the Pope wants the different parts of the church to have their voice in the way decisions are made. He thinks the Vatican has been too much the master of the church, and he wants to turn it into the servant. And the voices of people in different places should be heard. And it's true that they may be conservative on issues like homosexuality, but they'll be very radical on issues of international economics. So you'll see this Pope... He looks at the world from the bottom up. It's like looking down the wrong end of a telescope. He sees the world differently from the way that we see it in the rich world. Previous popes have been great teachers, and we've had a philosopher pope in John Paul. We've had a theologian in Benedict. But this pope, he goes up to a man like Francis went up to the leper, the man with the disfigured boils all on his face, and he hugs him and kisses him. And that just kind of speaks of the kind of thing that Jesus would do. And what he's doing with these new cardinals is he's putting more people into the College of Cardinals who will look at the world from the bottom up in the way that he does.
You've written extensively about the Vatican Bank and the shakeup there that Pope Francis is now overseeing. And you've even gone into the Vatican Bank. So let's just start with, what is the purpose of the Vatican Bank? What money is in there and what is it supposed to be used for?
The original purpose of the Vatican Bank was for religious orders and bishops and dioceses to put money into an organization which could transfer it out to the developing world. So you would be able to build churches, pay priests, build hospitals and clinics and so forth to get the money there. And a lot of these countries are places where there are no effective banking systems and they're failed states politically. So you need a secure system to transfer the money. The problem has been that system has been, because it's private, confidential, secretive, it has been misused by people using it for political purposes within the Vatican, or people using it to do money laundering and tax dodging and other allegations that have been made about the abuse of the Vatican Bank.
I want you to describe physically what the Vatican Bank is like and what you need to do to just like enter the bank, because you were actually invited in so that you could report on the reforms that were being made. And you describe the bank as having been a former dungeon. So just like describe
bank,
it for us.
The bank is in what used to be a medieval fortress, and it was held. It was a prison for a long time. It's a dungeon, and there are no windows at the bottom. You go in, and you've got to go past two or three Swiss guards. You then have to go through an electronic security check. You're checked in. When you get in, there's an ATM where you can take money out, and the instructions are in Latin, for goodness sake. So all the messages that this place sends out are, this is private, this is secret, keep out, you're not welcome here.
So how did you get in?
I got in because I'd written a book about the Pope, and I'd touched on the Vatican Bank in it, and they heard I was writing another edition of the book and said, well, do you want to come in and we'll show you what's going on here? And, I mean, that was in itself an amazing change. They got a press officer. The Vatican Bank's never had a press officer in the past. Its job was keeping journalists away, not welcoming them in and saying, let's show you how we're going about the reform process. But that's what they did, and they talked me through it.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Paul Vallely. He's a journalist who's written extensively about the Pope and the Vatican. His new book is called Pope Francis, The Struggle for the Soul of Catholicism. One of the problems that Pope Francis inherited was the priest's abuse of children, the sexual abuse of children in the church. What is Pope Francis trying to do to prevent that from ever happening again? And to deal with the men who are known to have been responsible but not necessarily punished.
Well, the Pope set up a commission for the protection of minors and vulnerable people, and it's supposed to put in place policies which mean that the circumstances in which priests can be that kind of sexual predator don't happen again. He's also got the Congregation for the Doctrine of Faith investigating individuals. It's taken him a while to do this. It took him a whole year before he set this up. And there is a lot of resistance within the Vatican. One cardinal said that apart from the resistance over the Vatican Bank and the finances, the most resistance that the Pope has encountered to anything has been on this sex abuse. Because there's a big faction within the Vatican and at very senior levels who think that having this all out in the open and having a commission and commissioners and making public statements is like washing your dirty linen in public, and it's bad for the church. So there's this kind of civil war almost within the Vatican. Francis himself is really behind the need for reform, but he's not pushing it as hard as he is in some other areas. And I think this is because Francis has an ambivalence. One of the things that he's worried about is people making false allegations against priests, and that's something that he had experience of in Argentina. So there's a kind of slightly conflicted quality to Francis on this. And the people who are on that papal commission have told me that no, it's all going in the right direction. It's just much slower than they would like. But I also detect that there is this serious resistance within the Vatican.
So Pope Francis is overseeing reforms in the Curia, in the Vatican Bank. He's leading the church in a slightly different direction culturally and socially. Do you think that the College of Cardinals knew what it was doing when they elected him Pope?
I think they knew to a certain extent, but they were surprised by how he's turned out and by how radical he's been and what a whirlwind. I mean, he's almost like Hurricane Francis, isn't he? There are some of the more conservative figures who've got buyer's remorse about him, but a lot of them, even amongst the conservatives, are delighted with the way that he's reinvigorated the church, and people, you know, ordinary Catholics are proud to be Catholics rather than being slightly ashamed of it because it was a church full of sex abuse and scandal and suppression of dissent and so forth. Now, suddenly, there's joy in the air, and people are smiling in Rome, and there's a new openness, and so that's largely welcomed. A lot of the cardinals felt that they needed to reassert the control of the wider universal church over Rome, and the code word they use for that in the church is collegiality. The church needs to be run like a college and not like a monarchy. Everyone had been speaking in the meetings before the election takes place about all these problems. And he stood up and he was the first person to make a speech which was different from that. And he said the church needs to get out onto the streets with the message of the gospel. It needs to go to the peripheries, both geographically and existentially. It needs to stop referring to itself. And he used an image of the moon. There's a Latin phrase, mysterium lunae. And it's the idea that the moon has no light. It just reflects the light of the sun. And so the church has no light. It just reflects the light of Christ. And so too many people in the church began to think that they had light of their own. And he used a very funny image. And he talked about the phrase in the Bible of Jesus knocking on the door. And he says people think that means Jesus wants to come into people's lives. That it may be that Jesus actually is knocking on the door to get out. He wants to get out of the church and get into the world. And this idea of taking the church out of the sacristy and into the streets and evangelizing. When he sat down after this short three-minute speech, one of the cardinals turned to another and said, "This is the man we need."
So one of the little changes that Pope Francis has made that I think is a very interesting one, though it's probably just some symbolic, is that he's no longer going to hand out the honorific title of Monsignor, which I think translates to my lord. Is that right?
Yes, my lord. And he thinks that's not appropriate. There are some individuals who are going to pay, like papal diplomats, who will keep it because he thinks they need some kind of handle. But the idea that this honorary title, which was bestowed upon priests for loyalty to the papacy or for doing what the bishop wanted for 40 years or whatever, yes, he's got rid of that. And there are lots of little symbolic things. And one of the things about the church is it's a place of symbol. So people say, oh, it's just symbolic. But it's not just symbolic in the church. Changing the symbols is changing the substance in some ways. And that's just one of them. And he's very studiedly changed with lots of these big gestures, like not living in the papal palace and living in the guest house and not going in the papal limousine and getting on the bus with the other cardinals, all those kind of things. They're not intuitive or spontaneous. This is how he was when he was Archbishop of Buenos Aires. So he's bringing that notion with him. Christians must change to respond to the modern world. That's what he's saying. And the change starts with the Pope.
What's the symbolic significance of no longer handing out the title Monsignor?
He thinks that it smacks of a kind of medieval notion. The idea that you call anybody my lord, it's kind of aristocratic. It's not part of the way the church should be relating to the world.
Paul Vallely is the author of the book Pope Francis, The Struggle for the Soul of Catholicism. His interview was recorded on September 15th. Sixty years ago, in September 1955, pianist Errol Garner's trio played a concert at a hall in Carmel, California. A fan recorded it, and that tape became the jazz bestseller Concert by the Sea. A new complete edition has just been released with twice as much music. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says it's more of the same in the best way.
Errol Garner's trio banging out Caravan, one of 11 newly issued performances on the complete Concert by the Sea. The old 1956 LP was a hit with folks who had just one jazz record and with the hipsters. In Holland, a teenage Han Benink wore out a few copies, playing along till he knew all of drummer Denzel Best's accents by heart. Garner was always great, and the recording's not so pristine, but something about this record just got to people. Garner ran an unusual jazz trio. There are no bass or drum solos here, and Denzel Best uses wire brushes only, no sticks. It was all Errol all the way, and he was basically self-propelled. Garner could get some Earl Hines fireworks going in his left hand, but more often, that left kept steady time like a great rhythm guitarist, unfazed by whatever his right hand was up to. Successful pop pianists usually feature the melody and will play a song the same way twice. Errol Garner was very popular, but he'd gallop away from a tune right out of the gate with the drummer and bassist Eddie Calhoun in hot pursuit. You'd think Garner's endless invention would be exhausting to listen to, but audiences were exhilarated. Every move was playful. The blustery introductions and caffeinated rhythms, the sudden dips in volume, the easy and obscure quotations and extended side trips. You wouldn't know it from this long excerpt, but this is Lullaby of Birdland. Little quote from Let's Fall in Love there. Improvising, Errol Garner might quote from another tune so often you could lose track of what he's actually playing. It's all part of the game he plays with the listener. He challenges you to keep up. On his Carmel concert, he quotes from Gene Ammons' Red Top a few minutes before playing it, a little preview. When he does get to the tune, he goes off on Charlie Parker's blues Now's the Time and riffs on Pop Goes the Weasel. That's Garner grunting along to his own jokes. Most of the music we've been hearing is now coming out for the first time, and it's all as creative and intense as the original Concert by the Sea. Errol Garner is consistently resourceful, and he's relentless, the terminator of jazz pianists. Often, this reviewer tries to give you the album highlight reel, but here you can dip in anywhere. It's all that good.
Kevin Whitehead writes for Point of Departure and is the author of Why Jazz. He reviewed Errol Garner's Concert by the Sea, now out in a new complete edition. The survival rate for women with breast cancer is higher than ever, approaching 90%. In this next interview, we'll hear Terry discuss recent improvements in diagnosing and treating breast cancer and in breast reconstruction with Dr. Elisa Port, author of the new book, The New Generation Breast Cancer Book. Dr. Port is Chief of Breast Surgery at Mount Sinai Medical Center in New York and co-director of its Dubin Breast Center.
Dr. Elisa Port, welcome to Fresh Air. What's the most cutting-edge development you're currently using?
There's a variety of different things going on. The cure rates from breast cancer have never been better. And while, of course, it is still a potentially lethal disease, we're doing better than ever before with all different subtypes of breast cancer. And that's mostly related to research advances. And so, obviously, drug development targeted at very, very specific tumor types. We can look at a woman and her individual tumor and try to customize and personalize treatments for her particular case. I can give you an example of that. There's a test that's commercially available called the Oncotype test, and that's a test that we frequently do for subsets of women with breast cancer to help us decide. It's basically a tumor profile test. We take a snippet of their tumor, and a genetic profile is run on that tumor to tell us a little bit more about how it's behaving biologically. And, for example, it can give us very personalized information for a woman that looked like she had a relatively indolent cancer, telling us, no, it's really behaving more aggressively than we would expect, and perhaps we want to treat that person more aggressively in turn with chemotherapy, that sort of thing. Alternatively, it could give us the opposite information. So some of these tests are really almost standard of care and more widely available. Some of them are being done at only the top tier centers.
When you are profiling a tumor, do you then test it with different forms of chemo to see which chemo can effectively attack the tumor?
This is definitely the wave of the future. We actually do that. We take snippets of tissue from women who have a more biologically aggressive form of breast cancer. It's known as triple negative breast cancer. And we're taking actually a snippet of that tumor and trying to grow it out in animal models and in cell models where we can potentially try out different types of chemotherapy to see what the response rate is before actually giving that to the person.
Mammograms have become a little more confusing because there are choices now. There's more than just the conventional mammogram X-ray. There's now 3D mammograms. Mm-hmm. There's the options of MRIs and possibly even sonograms. Can you just give us an overview of when you might want to do something other than the conventional mammogram?
Sure. I think this is a real hot button issue because there's so many mixed messages that are being sent to women across this country. Mammograms are definitely the most effective way to pick up breast cancer for the general population. And that's why the current recommendations are that every woman get screened with a mammogram starting at age 40. Period. End of discussion. Okay. That said, every person is different and their risk factors are different, and there absolutely may be a role for adding on to the mammogram, not instead of, for women depending on their risk level, their breast density, and again, their underlying health.
Why don't you describe what the 3D mammogram is?
Sure.
It's a relatively new option for women.
Yeah.
And it's not being prescribed for everyone. It's select women.
So 3D mammography is kind of a software update to conventional imaging where basically for a slightly higher dose of radiation, it takes multiple pictures through the breast. And you have to envision it. The way I explain it to women is it's almost like it's different paging through a book. So rather than generating one image in one direction and a second image in the other direction, you get multiple images, slices through the breast. And the thing that it's most helpful with is reducing the risk of what we call false positives. So saying there's something there when there really isn't, based on tissue overlap. So if you see a dense piece of tissue in one part of the breast and a dense piece of tissue in another part of the breast, and those lie over each other in one view, it may look doubly dense. When you take these sheets of tissue...
It may look like a tumor is what you're saying.
Yes, it absolutely can mimic looking like a tumor. And then what 3D mammogram can help with is separating out these pieces of tissue. So as you look at them individually, you realize it was just a summation effect of all these things overlapped, and really there's nothing there. In some cases, it can pick up cancers that mammograms miss. And overall, it's probably better than a regular mammogram or what's called a digital mammogram.
Now, what about an MRI? When do you think an MRI of the breast is called for?
MRI is a test that is very sensitive for picking up breast cancer. It's a test that's done with an IV injection where you receive a dye called gadolinium that circulates through the body, and it's picked up by areas of high blood flow. And one of the things that cause high blood flow is cancer. Cancer cells are growing and dividing very rapidly, and those involve increased blood flow in general. So MRIs are exquisitely sensitive to pick up cancer. So the question arises, why not MRIs for everyone? And the answer is because they are associated with a substantial risk of false positives. You do an MRI, you know, 14 things light up in the breast, and that generates a lot of anxiety, a lot of unnecessary biopsies, and so forth. And so MRIs are generally reserved for screening women at the highest risk for breast cancer. We have to be really judicious with the ordering of MRIs. And those of us who do this for a living just have seen this play out time and time again. You know, you don't want to order an MRI as a knee-jerk kind of response. And you want to think through what the possible outcomes are in each individual patient.
Because you don't want it to lead to a lot of unnecessary testing.
Correct. Yeah. Right.
And scaring of women.
Of course. And unnecessarily when there's very little added benefit.
Yeah.
So obviously in the women who are at the highest risk for breast cancer, we worry more in those women about missing a cancer. And so the bar is much lower for doing these imaging studies, et cetera. And so we do, again, it goes back to our theme, and it's one of the themes in the book, you know, of it's not a one-size-fits-all world anymore. And we, you know, those of us who do this for a living know or try as best we can to customize approaches for each individual person.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Elisa Port. She's the author of the new book, The New Generation Breast Cancer Book. She's chief of breast surgery at Mount Sinai Medical Center and also the co-director of the center's Dubin Breast Center. Let's talk about mastectomies. A lot has changed with mastectomies. I would ask you about who should get a lumpectomy versus a mastectomy, but I think that's so specific probably to each individual patient. I'm not sure how useful a more general discussion of that would be. Or do you tell me?
Well, I think there are long and short answers for this question. And I think the most important thing that women know is that there are both medical reasons why a woman needs one or the other and personal reasons why a woman could choose one or the other. And that is the epicenter of my job on a daily basis, is working with a woman and giving her sort of the medical input and then saying, these are your safe options. And women don't always have all of the options open to them.
So are there specific guidelines for when a mastectomy is absolutely required?
Sure. To give you a couple of general examples, you know, a woman who has a large amount of cancer in her breast, where from a technical standpoint, it would be very difficult to do a smaller operation, make a small incision, get an area out, get what we call clear margins, the whole area out, and leave her with a result that she's happy with, that's one very, very common reason why we would recommend a mastectomy. Another, and this is a little bit more of a moving target, is in general, a woman who has, even if the areas are small, in general, when more than one area of cancer is found in the breast, a mastectomy is usually recommended. Although in selected cases, people are starting to do what we call double lumpectomies, although generally it's not the standard of care.
So when your patient is having reconstructive surgery and they're doing it with an implant, you keep the original breast skin to cover the implant?
Yes, absolutely. So in general, most mastectomies that are done, especially those with reconstruction, are what are called skin-sparing mastectomies, where we can make really relatively small incisions. If we are removing the nipple, we go above the nipple and below the nipple with our small incisions and remove the small ellipse of tissue, remove all of the breast through there. We can even check the nodes through that incision and leave the vast majority and preserve the vast majority of the skin envelope, where then at the same surgery, a plastic surgeon comes in with an implant or a smaller version, a temporary implant, what we called a tissue expander, and can inflate that to a degree that fills out that remaining skin envelope.
And that requires coming back several times for further surgeries?
Yes. So in general, you know, it can be challenging for the plastic surgeons, although many are able to do it, and it's obviously, again, on a case-by-case basis. It can be challenging to put the full-size implant in at the same time as the mastectomy surgery. And that's for a couple of reasons. You know, the skin that, after you do a mastectomy, the skin needs to heal, and it's somewhat traumatized from obviously removing the breast tissue beneath it, because that is the source of a large amount of its blood supply. And one of the things that can put further tension and pressure on that skin and affect wound healing is if you put a full-size implant under there, that puts a lot of tension on the skin. So in many, many cases, putting the smaller tissue expander is advantageous because it really gives the skin a chance to recover without being under tension. And then over time, 2-3 weeks after surgery, an injection of saline into that temporary expander fills it out a little bit, and gradually the skin is stretched so that it can adapt every step of the way.
When you have successful reconstructive surgery through the more standard procedure, which is with the implants, how sensitive is the breast tissue to the touch following healing?
Right. You mean the overlying skin, because theoretically there shouldn't be.
Right.
Yeah. It's a really important point. And it is whether, I think one of the main points, you know, we're doing more and more nipple preservation mastectomies now. But I think the key point that I have to make sure I inform women of is that whether you save the nipple, you don't save the nipple, most of the sensation is gone. And that's because the nerve endings that come through with the breast tissue are by and large removed. So for the most part, there is a lot of numbness in that area. I mean, for every woman, it's sort of very gradual. When you start out, for example, touching the clavicle, they can feel that, which is your collarbone. And as you move down the chest after a mastectomy, it varies from person to person as to where the sensation ends and the numbness begins. But it's a really important part of my kind of, you know, the consultation. Women, you know, it would be natural to assume that if you save the appearance of the nipple, you'd be saving sensation, when you really aren't in most cases.
I know some women who have cancer in one breast and need a mastectomy wonder if they should have a mastectomy of the other breast because they fear that the cancer will spread to the other side. How frequently does that actually happen? You know, that the cancer jumps to the other side.
Yeah, this is really one of the most important, a great opportunity to clarify what risks a woman has, and of course the reasons for both for and against removing the other breast. So, to answer your question, the most important thing for a woman to know is that when she has breast cancer on one side, breast cancer can spread. It can spread to other parts of the body. It does not spread to the other breast. So women can develop a new separate cancer in the other side, but for most women, that likelihood is extremely low, and most women do tend to overestimate their risks of getting a new cancer on the other side. Also critically important to know is that the removal of the other healthy breast in no way reduces a woman's chances of the cancer that they have, particularly an invasive cancer, spreading. So there's really no difference in survival between removing the other healthy breast and not.
I imagine you've had to tell a lot of women that they have cancer.
Yes.
What does that take out of you to have to convey so many times such bad news?
I wish I could say it got easier as it goes along, but it certainly doesn't. And there's degrees of it, it affects me every single time. But it is what we're trained to do. And I think for me personally, the only redeeming part is that that's followed very closely by, and here's what we're going to do to make you better. I think it would be much harder for me as a person to take care of a kind of cancer where there weren't so many amazing options for treatment and there wasn't as much room for optimism. And I think for me personally, that is what keeps me going.
If you don't mind my asking, do you worry about getting breast cancer yourself?
I do, of course, as a woman. I don't think I do obsessively. I have a complicated family history, but we don't have a huge breast cancer component in our family. But, the average woman's risk is 10% over her lifetime. And I don't think I think obsessively about it, but I do what I have to do to make sure I'm being checked. Exactly what I would recommend for, I do for myself what, I do for my patients exactly what I would do for myself.
Dr. Alisa Port is the author of the new book, The New Generation Breast Cancer Book. You'll find a longer version of our conversation with Terry on Fresh Air's podcast at itunes.com/freshair. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.